As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to The Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday,
on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to Tampering.
This beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Panic.
To be able to bring people together.
What do you do, baby?
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
stop talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Was it right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about it. I can't even mention teams anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
Trial you want with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
Hey, we don't think I have tampered with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened.
Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast, part of the Athletic NBA Show Network. I am Sam Amick here, as always, NBA national writer at The Athletic with my guys Anthony Slater out west, Fred Katz out east. What's up, gentlemen?
How you doing?
Doing great.
It's wonderful to see you guys again.
Likewise. We are going to dive right in. Here's what we're doing this week. I feel like, you know, I keep saying this, we have the two perfect guys on this pod a lot of times, these teams that you might not think we're going to talk a lot about, but the Wizards, and then to a much lesser degree, the Warriors, I guess, when you talk about the Brad Beal trade market, whether or not it exists, the Wizards star, and the question that has kind of post-James Harden loomed over this season about, does he want out? Is he going anywhere? He is, you know, by all accounts, the best player that you know, at least that we talk about. But Fred's going to weigh in on what's happening there. But before we dive in, gents, to everything, we're going to talk about the Nets and their defense. We're going to talk about everything around the league. I just want to let you know this pod is sponsored. I never thought I would say something like this, and they're not paying us, to be clear. Sponsored by White Claw.
Do I at least get free White Claw?
I just had to go there because Wizards coach Scott Brooks, with one of my favorite quotes of the entire year, if you somehow missed it, the Wizards beat the Nets 149-146, and this is the super team Nets. Now, granted, no James Harden, but 149-146, incredible finish. Bradley Beal hits a late three. Russell Westbrook, who had the steal?
Harrison Matthews.
Thank you. It gets it to Russell Westbrook, and he hits another three, and the Nets, the super team, gets felled by a Wizards squad that has been struggling all year long. Wizards coach Scott Brooks, post-game, says, and I quote, "That was the first game all year I had a White Claw." And then Freddie Katz, Wizards beat writer, of course, investigative reporter, follows up and says, and this is, I'm reading from Fred's tweet, "Scott Brooks, on the precipice of gaining a White Claw endorsement, admits he does not like mango-flavored White Claws." So close. And before I get your thoughts and your reactions on this incredible journalism, guys, according to Urban Dictionary, White Claw is the ultimate alcoholic party drink that emerged in 2019, has become the new addiction to underage kids and college students for being so low in calories.
Sam's showing his age right here. He's going to Urban Dictionary to give a White Claw definition.
Nothing self-referential. According to Urban Dictionary, White Claws are what Fred drinks when he wants to hang out.
Can I also most commonly? Well, here we go. Frank, that's Fred. We're combining words here.
drank most commonly by white boys whose fathers are lawyers. Fred is not a lawyer.
He's not a lawyer. That's half right, though. I will go for a White Claw when I'm in the right situation and they're out. It's not really my go-to. I will say I do have a theory on this.
Okay. Does he really drink White Claws? I need to know this.
Yes, he really does drink White Claws.
Scotty Brooks, what is happening?
He's trying to keep his figure into his later age, I assume.
Wow. That's why they're 100 calories, I think, a can, okay. Right? I mean, my theory is Scott has a daughter in college and a son who just graduated college.
He's trying to connect with his daughter in college.
He's got him. The kids have him at home. Yeah. They probably drink him. It's a very like collegiate. Definitely. Yeah. It's a collegiate drink. His son goes to Georgetown Law. So he's right there locally.
So instead of his father being a lawyer, his son is an aspiring lawyer.
Exactly. It's just the reverse.
All right. The one thing I wanted to say before we get on the ground, wizard stuff from Fred, Sam's a hater. This is the second time he's scheduled a Bradley Beal trade conversation after they beat the Nets. Remember last time we did it, we were talking after they went into Brooklyn and won two of their four wins this season. And after each of the biggest ones, we're talking Brad Beal trades.
I'm a hater. I mean, listen, I'm pretty sure, and we're recording this on Monday, it will air on Tuesday morning. You can call me a hater all you want. I think Fred's the one who co-authored a story with Arsham Sharania, at least looking at the Bradley Beal situation.
Oh, it's very topical, Sam. I'm just joking with you. But it is funny how it's worked. We've like planned to do a Bradley Beal one, and then they have this huge win over the Nets, and then the same thing happens.
Well, and not only that, and we'll get into the macro of it, but also the game itself. I did kind of love that all in one game, Bradley Beal is going viral on social media for, you know, kind of, loafing. Bad body language. Yeah, loafing, a bad body. And then he turns around, he ends up with 37, you know, which doesn't really tell the story, but still, you know, the optics were bad. And then the box score was good. To set the stage real quick, guys, for the listeners who might not be all in on Brad Beal, we are also going to be getting into Nikola Jokic, who ended the Jazz's 11-game winning streak almost by himself, and maybe a little bit of MVP discussion and where the Nugget star fits in. And last but certainly not least, what we're going to call the net rating investigation. There's, you know, kind of some weird misnomers within the top net rating teams in the NBA this year, and the question of are those, in fact, you know, the teams we think are going to be the best. But let's talk Wizards, Beal, all the above. That game was crazy. So, Fred, you joked last couple weeks, about how you don't cover basketball anymore. This team had been severely impacted by COVID protocol. Jokes aside, and I know it sucks that you're on your couch watching this instead of the arena, Did you go?
You're not going. No, I'm on my couch.
You're on your couch. But like,
technically, I'm on my Lazy Boy.
There you go.
Drinking a White Claw.
White Claw in hand. This was a hell of a game and an incredible finish. So was it, you know, at least exhilarating to be covering basketball again?
I got to write about an actual basketball storyline. You know, it's funny because you mentioned the piece that I'm writing for Tuesday morning about Beal trade stuff. Originally, I was probably going to write that and finish it up after the game and run it on Monday. And then that game happened and Russell Westbrook kind of looks like the Russell Westbrook we all know, goes for 41. It's not just the line. It's the fact that he's spry and he's getting to the rim and he's getting out in transition. He looks like that fast, explosive athlete we're also used to seeing finishing around the rim and over Kevin Durant and crunch time and all that. Like, this is the story. I'm writing something that will make Wizards fans happy after a game that made them that exhilarated. You know, that's... You got to capture the moment. So I pushed back the Beal thing a day, and I wrote a Westbrook story for Monday morning because I just thought that was the proper tone after a game like that. Yeah, I mean, you get into this because you like writing about basketball, and you like basketball. So it's nice to write about basketball as opposed to all the other stuff that we have to write about this season.
Well, and you had a slice of context that I thought, you know, on the Westbrook front that was so telling, and I'm going to read it here, talking about his health or lack thereof recently and the fact that he just has not played like the guy. Like, love him or hate him, the best version of Russ is relentless at the rim, attacking, aggressive, super confident all the time. As you wrote, the left quad has bothered Westbrook ever since he banged it during training camp in early December. He's not looked like himself since, unable to power to the hoop in ways that made him a 9-time All-Star. This, Fred, is what I thought was so insightful. Only 14% of his shots coming into Sunday had come at the rim less than half of his previous career low and almost three times worse than his ratio last season. Tough to tell, and it's only one game. But, I mean, from the way Russ makes it sound, is this something he can keep up now that he is feeling better?
Yeah. I mean, something else I included in that story, which really shows, I mean, he took 19 shots in the paint against Brooklyn. I know Brooklyn's defense is nothing. I mean, it is, what do they have, a 120 defensive rating since they traded for Harden? So over the last 3 weeks or so, 2.5 weeks, they're...
I don't mean to be the fact check guy. I have his shot chart in front of me. Was it 19 or 16?
I hand counted it. So okay. I counted 19.
NBA.com had 10 out of 16 down low.
You know what was the stat that shocked me most that Fred put out there? I think you said he had one dunk all year.
Yeah, right? He had one dunk all year.
He used to have one. Well, not only that,
we're just going to keep, you know, boosting Fred's ego here, because Fred is a man who is, you know, very well versed in the written word. And I loved how on the one dunk Slater, he not only talks about the one dunk, he says he has one dunk all season. It came on a wide open fast break and had all the verve of grandma placing pies on the windowsill.
Fred was loving that retelling of his story.
All right, guys, the podcast, right? That's the whole thing.
Sounds like Sam's larger question is like, is this Kevin Durant is in the building, let's throw it back one time to like save Scott Brooks and the Wizards like season for 2 days? Or is he about to have a month straight of like relatively regular performances somewhat similar to this?
So the reason why I think it's a real thing, even if it's, I'm not saying he's going to go for 41, 10, and 8 every night or play with the, you know, the relentlessness that we talked about every single night. I mean, that was a special performance by, you know, regular old school Russell Westbrook standards. What I do think, though, is that over the first month and a half or so of the season, he wasn't physically capable of doing this for 5 minutes, let alone for a full game. I mean, he was struggling to blow by Kevin Huerter and Kobe White and these guys who we don't even think of as anything close to one-on-one defenders, you know, guys who he would have manhandled in the past. And he was resorting to going into the post, and he was losing his handle when he was trying to get by those guys. And it looked like more of a flashback performance. And, you know, it remains to be seen on how often he's going to be able to play like this. I mean, you know, actually, one of the commenters in the story you referenced made the point it brought up a Steve Nash quote that's probably 10 years old by now, where Nash said, as you age, it's not that you can't do it like you used to anymore at the beginning. It's that it takes so much time and so much more preparation to be able to do it like you used to. And you have to change the way you prepare and adjust the way that you approach the game. And I think it's such an insightful quote, ironically, by the guy that Westbrook went up against last night. And I think Westbrook's learning how he has to handle his body differently. He's talked about how he's approached rehab differently than before, much more patient. He used to be obsessed with playing every single minute of every single game, obsessed with it. And I think it's been hard for him to get rid of that. And he's kind of put those desires aside now as he's 32 years old. I think he's not going to look like the guy he was 5 years ago. He's 32, and his career has been predicated on athleticism and being able to just physically beat down his opponents. But I think he's going to look better than he did the first month and a half of the season, because that was just a different dude than we saw on Sunday.
As a quick aside before we get into the Beal talk, can I take a moment as we head into Super Bowl weekend to just repeat what everybody around the country and the world has been saying? Like the idea of Tom Brady doing what he's doing at 43 years old, as a fellow 43-year-old myself, and playing the most brutal physical game on the planet is mind-boggling. Because you talk about Russ, 32 is old, and the way he plays is, I mean, he's got, you know, dog years, so to speak, with his style. But you know, it does also make you wonder. We're asking, can he keep it up for this season? You know, Russ is a guy who, in his mind, I'm sure would love to play till he's 40.
Well, how many more years does he have the big money? Three more, is that right?
Three, including this one.
Ooh, yeah. I mean,
It does make you worry a little bit, like, what is 36-year-old Russell Westbrook look? Forget about money, but just what's he look like?
You know, more than a little bit.
Yeah.
More than a lot. A lot. I mean, that's why that's why, I mean, he's been traded twice in the last two off seasons. I mean, it's why he's being swapped for supermax contracts who people are deeming at the time as undesirable.
Remember how Iverson's career kind of faded quickly, right? That's what I was kind of getting reminded of early this season, where you saw it not end well in Houston, and then it's traded again, and suddenly you're seeing Russell Westbrook now in a new jersey. It kind of felt Iverson-y at the end. Remember, it was like Grizzlies. What other teams was he on?
Detroit.
And then he went back to the Sixers right after he wouldn't come off the bench with the Grizzlies.
Yeah, and that was the thing. He never seemed to want to accept like that aging role. And my question with Westbrook is always, is he going to be able to be non-high usage, fit in where he gets in, maybe off the bench at some point? But that's a question for down the line. Right now, the Wizards clearly need him to be like their second best player, right?
Yeah,
they do indeed. Their first best player. Let's get into the other topic, guys. Fred, we are like that, you know, reflection of the thirsty NBA fan crowd, where everybody outside of DC wants Bradley Beal traded. And, you know, we don't advocate for certain things, but we're just guilty of being fascinated by the, you know, the transaction, you know, part of what we do. And Brad has a incredible amount of interest around the league. But the key question, of course, has been, where is his head at? How do the Wizards see it? What did you guys report this morning? What can you share about how you see that situation now?
So from my vantage point, Brad has made no indication that he wants to be traded. And the Wizards have no interest in trading him. And I know it's NBA Twitter's not going to believe me. NBA Twitter's just going to say whatever. I saw him. His shoulders were slouched. He didn't
can
like
I,
it.
Can I'm going to interrupt for a second. I hope that I think the look on Slater's face showed me that the Wi-Fi tripping. It was perfect, though, because it tripped right as you gave your answer, Fred, and then it sped you up as if you were one of those guys on the commercials where they have to, like, you know, say what they say really quick. So it's actually perfect. We're going to cut that clip and have Fred saying he's not going anywhere, he doesn't want to go anywhere, stop asking, you know, put it on every pod. I'm guessing, though, there's more to your story than that, because in some of this, I think, might involve Slater's team, because the Warriors are a squad that's on the lookout for the type of star talent that could maximize the Steph Currys and the Draymond Greens when Klay Thompson gets healthy, a guy like that. From the Warriors and beyond, what did you guys learn about how the market looks?
Yeah, I mean, from the way that I'm trying to contextualize this is that the context inside the Wizards, from my vantage point, is the same as it's kind of been all along. Beal has not asked for a trade, and the Wizards don't have any interest in trading him. But I think the context around the league has changed, in which you guys know as well as I do, there's always a guy, right? There's always a guy who we look at as the next guy. And that's not just a media fabrication. That's a real thing. That's how the league operates. And Harden was the guy. And post-Harden trade, Beal is now the guy. And I think even last year and before he signed his extension in October of 2019, there was obviously lots of talk around the league of, are the Wizards going to trade Bradley Beal? And there were clearly a lot of people around the league who thought they should trade Bradley Beal. It would be better off for them if they make a deal. But I think now the tone around those thoughts has kind of changed. You just kind of ask people around the league, well, what do you think? I think the attitude is just kind of, all right, just this is happening. Just make your decision. You know, wake up and smell the coffee. You guys are 4-12. Trade your star to us, and then we can move on like we're supposed to. And they feel like, all right, well, the Wizards just won't cooperate. And so I think the tone around it is different. They could get a ton if they decided to trade him. I mean, they could get with the amount that Drew Holiday went for and the amount of picks that it requires to get a star now, the dude's averaging 35 points a game and leading the league in scoring. I mean, they could get... I mean, Slater, let's talk Warriors, because they're one of the most intriguing ones. You got to ask for everything.
Yeah, well, first, I think there's a sense around the league of the inevitability of Washington's situation, where if you're in the moment as Washington, you still are holding on to hopes. Hey, you know, Westbrook looked good tonight. Maybe they can revive it and kind of get back into the Eastern Conference, like, lower seed picture. And perhaps that does happen. But I think around the league, there's a sense of, like, come March, this team's probably pretty obviously not going to be in the playoffs. Their defense... We saw it last night. They won a game. They still gave up like 144 points. And the belief that Westbrook's not the answer. So I do think there is a feeling that eventually, even if it's not, you know, month one, month two of the season, Beal probably will be on the table. And then that alerts teams to like ready themselves to like, what would they be willing to give up? And yeah, I mean, like the Warriors seem like the most obvious partner for what the Wizards need. Because, you know, you go and look at Philadelphia. We could talk about like a Simmons for Beal swap, but that just puts the Wizards in the same situation where they have a very good player that suddenly should they trade Ben Simmons then. Whereas what the Warriors can provide is a really soft path for a rebuild, right? Because, you know, you would get, if the Warriors decided to put these guys on the table, we're talking about Wiseman, who is a 19-year-old who can come in with high, high upside, but he's not going to help you win now, right? So you're still going to not have a good season this season. They have the Minnesota pick, which by the day is looking better because of how bad the Wolves are looking. And those are two premier young rebuilding assets. And then, you know, you can get salary filler along with that. Is it Oubre? Do we talk Wiggins? You know, something like that. So they can salary match and provide two tent pole, you know, rebuilding options. Probably, you know, we can talk about should the Warriors put that on the table, but do you see any other franchise out there that has something that could match that?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, we have to wait to see what the Wizards' priorities would be, which I don't know the answer to that question because they haven't even got to a point where they say they want to trade Beal. You know, that's steps farther down the line. And ultimately, that comes as much from ownership sometimes as it does from management, who's going to set the big picture stuff. And Ted Leonsis has often led a team that has wanted to chase that final playoff seed, right? I mean, that's kind of how they operated this year. It's how they operated certainly under, you know, Ernie Grunfeld, especially in the latter Ernie Grunfeld years before they before Leonsis fired him a couple of summers ago. So maybe Simmons is a type of deal that they want. You know, I think there are other teams that are really interesting. Toronto is always interesting for just like a we're going to take a risk and go get our guy post Kawhi trade. Miami is interesting. You know, obviously Duncan Robinson is a free agent after this year and you'd have to pay him, which I think hurts his value. But if you love Tyler Hero and I think they did like Precious Achiuwa coming into the draft. I mean, that's something in Miami can trade you picks starting in 2025. I think Atlanta is an interesting dark horse. They have all those young guys, and the Wizards loved Okongwu, by the way, heading into the draft. You know, you could do something. You know, Hunter looks, I know he just got hurt, but Hunter has looked fabulous this year. Herter is a nice young player, and John Collins
situation is something that people are monitoring. I mean, he, you know, didn't get that extension done. You know, we had reported earlier in the year about kind of some frustration over functionality in the offense. They're playing better recently, but he's somebody that you know, I think would have a lot of market.
Yeah, for sure.
I think if I was advising the Wizards, like, you got to go youth, right? You know, Atlanta has youth. Denver, if they
say if, let's just make this a thing. Let's just dun, 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 Slater, Wizards advisor. What do you got? Let's go.
Well, you know, Denver, if they would put Michael Porter Jr. on the table, I don't know. Like that's a young, growing piece. Whereas, like,
I think they would.
Yeah,
that's just I think they would because in the Harden stuff, they were on the periphery of that, and it was always understood that Jamal Murray, no Porter. You know, I definitely thought, you know, for Harden that they would have, and to me, Beal is in that same tier.
Like, if you're Washington, you want to get young guys with growth potential who are on rookie deals. And that is why Wiseman is such an appealing piece. Appealing enough that, you know, I just did a Warriors plus minus podcast with all of our Bay Area guys. And, I mean, we all don't even know if the Warriors should do it with Wiseman. I mean, I'm not sure they would even put him on the table in a real trade. And that is what I'm going to write. I'm going to have something out Monday to, or Tuesday, I should say, morning too, on that thought process from a Warrior standpoint of, do you upgrade your chance of winning the title next year by going after Bradley Beal by what we'll say like 20%, 25%. They probably wouldn't be the favorites with Beal. They would be much better, but you potentially mortgage a guy who might be an all NBA center for 5-6 years down the line.
Slater, at the risk of making you repeat your plus minus pod, I don't know how deep you guys went on it, but like from a Warriors perspective, I do wonder, like, all right, this year's one thing, but talk to me real briefly about next year. And I mean, first of all, if the fans somehow missed Klay Thompson's commentary in the Pistons game the other day, that was epic and amazing. And Klay showing on that broadcast how hungry he is to get back. So when Klay gets back, what does that look like with a Steph, Draymond, Klay Thompson, Bradley Beal, existence? That seems pretty challenging.
It's extreme.
It's a good problem to have.
It's extreme small ball. It's extreme money, by the way, and particularly if we're not talking about Wiggins being in the trade, and I don't think they would necessarily want to. They're loving what Wiggins is providing as a wing, and he would actually be a forward, almost a small ball four if we're talking about this, like, jumbo small shooting lineup. That's five guys technically on max deals. Now Draymond's max is smaller because it was like a max extension, but I believe Marcus Thompson had the number on the podcast. If they, and they could do this trade without putting Wiggins in it, and let's say they did, they would have their entire starting lineup would be making, I think, $176 million, which is way over the line. Now look, if Joe Lacob's got the appetite, no fan's gonna complain about it, but monetary stuff comes into the situation, and then positional, right? I mean, Bradley Beal, as awesome as he is, he's kind of Klay Thompson in a sense. I mean, there's overlap there. Whereas the appeal of Wiseman in the draft and the appeal of Wiseman that remains is 7-footer, center, you know, shot blocker, rim protector, especially as Draymond Green is aging past the point where he is a rim protector. Draymond Green has 2 blocks this whole season, 2 total blocks. Andrew Wiggins is there, and Wiseman are the best shot blockers. So, I don't know that the Warriors would mortgage the future for Beal, but it creates a very interesting thought experiment.
Yeah, so one of the things that you mentioned, which I think is worth mentioning in any sort of Beal conversation, I think it's a lot harder to do this trade in season. When you talk about just the constructs of putting together a normal NBA trade. Because, okay, so Slater, you're talking about doing a trade without Wiggins. That means compiling a bunch of salaries. You can do it, Oubre, but you got to compile a bunch of salaries.
Oubre really helps them in that situation.
Oubre gets you halfway there, right? By himself, he's what, 15?
Yeah, and Wiseman, because he's the number 2 overall pick, so about 8 or so. So they can actually get very close with just those two.
So it's hard, though, to do a 3-for-1 or a 4-for-1 deal in season. And if the Wizards want to be able to explore that stuff, they want to be able to explore, you know what, let's see if New Orleans will give us 3 or 4 of their non-Zion, non-Ingram young guys, or if Miami will give us 3 of their guys, or whomever else. They get to a point where they want to trade them. It's harder to make those deals in season because the Wizards have 15 guys right now. So now you got to waive 2 or 3, depending on how many are coming back. Whomever is trading for Beal is probably a good team who's trying to contend. Otherwise, why the heck are you trading for Bradley Beal when he has 1.5 years left? And now they're way short on roster spots. So now you're going out and having to fill out the rest of a roster in the middle of a season, which is not easy. So it's certainly not impossible, and we've seen it happen. It's one extra thing that's a little more complicated. And when the Wizards aren't at a place where they want to do it, and Beal has kind of always said, like, Beal, I've talked about this with him before. He's obsessed. I shouldn't say obsessed, but he's really infatuated with the Dirk Nowitzki title. He loves the idea of a guy spending his career in one spot, fighting really hard for one spot, and eventually winning. Obviously, the Wizards are not close to that right now. They're 4-12, and they're tied for the worst winning percentage in the Eastern Conference. But that plays a big part into his mentality, right? During this whole thing.
It's the Lillard mentality. Now, Lillard's had more success in Portland. He's gotten them to a conference finals. But there's respect in Damian Lillard's career, even though I don't think a title's coming down the line for Damian Lillard in Portland. But who around the league doesn't respect what Damian Lillard's done in Portland?
Yeah, I mean, can I read something to you that Brad said to me? This would have been a year and a half ago.
Tell him no. We've read.
No, this is already the Fred celebrating Fred Katz's.
Yeah, I was gonna say we've read enough of his work on the podcast.
No, this isn't my work. This is something that Brad said to me about 1.5 years ago that I just called up, and I think it's just.
Who
did
he say it
context.
To again? To you? I didn't hear that part.
Yeah, who is this quote?
And
to?
Then. And then I wrote it in an exclusive story at The Athletic DC.
Okay.
So we were talking about super teams, and he said, and just the possibility of trades. This is how long this narrative has been going on, by the way, because this is in All-Star 2019. So this is like 2 years ago. He says to me, I kind of hate it. I hate super teams. And that's just me. Like everybody, just get your own team and try to win with what you've got. So I think that quote is a really good encapsulation of how Brad thinks. Like that, now that was 2 years ago.
Slater, yeah. have you ever heard a superstar say anything like that and then change their mind later on? Have you ever come to mind?
Number 35 from Texas. what's interesting about all this is like, and I think this is what we're seeing early this season. Bradley Beal has maintained this idea, but there isn't a clear path to winning for the Wizards, and it seems like every game that's smacking him in the face that like it's not even just that like, hey, Bradley Beal, like you're probably not gonna win the title this year. Like, they're not good. They're not Damian Lillard's Portland Trail Blazers, who are at least in the mix. Like, they're a lottery team, and
I also think No, I just think that from Brad to the rest of the league, one thing we continue to gloss over and forget, we complain about being, you know, the changes of life in this COVID pandemic time. I think in general, guys don't want to get moved right now. You know what I mean? From a life standpoint, you know, moving your family, your people, whoever it might be during this time, I think in general, people have the attitude that with the restrictions and the uncomfortableness that has come with this entire season, I would think that that is playing some part of Brad's calculus.
Yeah, I think so. I think it would play in some part of anyone's calculus. I mean, look,
right.
I think this is probably the hardest season to get traded, non-basketball edition. I just mean, imagine getting traded, not knowing anybody in your new spot. It's hard enough lifestyle-wise anyway with the move, and he's got kids and you know, all of that, and a family. It's hard enough with all that. Now there are restrictions in which you're not allowed to go to dinner to get to know your new teammates. You know,
right.
you have to stay 6 feet away from your teammates. Like, it's a hard year to get traded. And I don't know how much. I wouldn't be surprised if that factors in, but it would certainly factor into me. But I mean, I don't think Beal is at a spot where he's saying, I need to get out of here. That doesn't mean he's never going to get to that spot. The reason I read that quote is because I thought it just kind of gave good context to where his head has been and why he's not necessarily aligned with what we see from a lot of guys. So we'll see. I can't tell the future, but we'll see.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Fred, maybe if we say that this pod is brought to the listeners by whatever Wi-Fi company you have, they'll help you out. And
oh no,
yeah, that's all right. It keeps jumping in a little bit. We're good. We're good. We got most of that. It's a good place to pivot as well, guys. I want to talk about the Denver Nuggets and about Nikola Jokic. It's shameless plug here. This week, probably Wednesday, at this point, I'm going to have an interview with Rudy Gobert, Jazz big man who, you know, Utah had won 11 in a row and he's doing some good things. Yeah. Well, that's the funny. You got to love how the narratives never seem to hold up as we try to put our quote unquote content together. You know, Rudy and I, though, thankfully, our conversation was much bigger picture. It was really, I enjoyed it and tried to learn about how he and the Jazz, you know, kind of got from go back to March where Rudy was the first publicly known NBA player to contract COVID to the bubble disappointment, losing to Denver in the playoffs, you know, and then now looking great. So they win 11 in a row. And again, Rudy will have his thoughts on that on our website this week. But Denver steals their thunder and comes in with Mr. Jokic dropping 47, a career high. And I think finally piercing through that mainstream noise, I guess, like, you know, that conversation where he's in the MVP conversation. He needs to be in it. It's always been a what am I trying to say? Relationship to overall success, and the Nuggets being around 500 early wasn't helping him. But they're now sitting there at 12-8. They got Detroit tonight, so we'll see how that game goes. But guys, he's playing out of his mind. And this dude, just a little bit of historical context, he's coming in at 26 points, 11.8 boards, and so almost 27 points, by the way, 8.6 assists. And I know it's early, but right now the only other player in the history of the game to hit those 26, 11, and 8 thresholds is the one and only Oscar Robertson. And so I love what he's doing, and to do it the way that he did against the two-time Defensive Player of the Year in Rudy Gobert, and I think he had 22 in the first quarter. I mean, he just destroyed him.
30 in the first half, yeah.
Yeah, no, it was impressive stuff. Where do you fall on not only Jokic, but we're kind of getting into that time where I think it's okay to start talking MVP a little bit. How do you guys see it?
I think he's right up there. I mean, I think he's certainly top three. He has carried that offense, and their defense has been kind of another story. It's been a little better lately. But when he is out there, it's just unbelievable to be able to watch how that offense produces with his passing, with his distributing. I think there's a pretty good case for him as the most important offensive player in the league right now to his team's success. It is wild to see how differently Denver operates when he's on the floor versus when he's not. And they've got good offensive players on that team too. He's just another animal.
Well, and this is a niche kind of distinction, but as my buddy and colleague Mike Singer of the Denver Post had said recently, this is so far the best season passing for a big man in the history of basketball. And, you know, that's talking about the Bill Waltons of Lottie Divots, guys like that. That part of it is just incredible to watch. And it's during a year where Jamal Murray is not, like we've talked about, been the bubble version of Jamal, and he has certainly been carrying them.
He's dragged them to this conversation. You know, this is not a 1-2 punch right now. This is kind of like a 1A and a distant 2 on their team. And, you know, you mentioned MVP. It's a clear top three in the MVP right now. It's LeBron, who probably at this point is most people's MVP because the Lakers have looked like the clear best team, although they've hit some hiccups on the trip and LeBron's playing awesome. Embiid, because the Sixers are the number one team in the East and he's been awesome. And then Jokic, probably over the last week, I think has leaped Embiid, and you could make an argument. The argument against Jokic right now not being the MVP is not statistical. It's just the fact that the Nuggets, I believe, are fourth in the West. I spent last week saying, oh, the Jazz have leaped, Denver in the conversation. And then Jokic does that to Gobert, and Denver's really hot, even though Michael Porter Jr., how long did he end up missing? How many games did he miss? And he should theoretically be their third best player. And then their second best player is not having a very good season. So, Nikola Jokic, what he did in the playoffs times, like he's probably even, grown on that. And remember how much he shocked us in the playoffs? As he's the type of player that we assumed would be exploited in the playoffs, right? You know, you're a regular season player. You're going to get targeted in the pick and roll.
No.
Some of your slow games not going to work against the physicality. That was not an issue at all in the playoffs. And yeah, I mean, he's a top five player in basketball right now.
Well, the Embiid debate is an interesting one because at its base, I think it comes down to just how do you view the game, because the defensive impact that Embiid's going to bring obviously far exceeds, what Jokic is doing on that end. Because other than that, it's kind of a wash in terms of scoring and rebounding right now. They're both around 27, 28, and 11. I think Embiid certainly has got a good candidacy there, and the Sixers sitting atop the East matters a great deal. Again, it's early, but narrative plays a part, and Slater, I think you hit on it, which is that idea, that notion that everything around Jokic has not gone well and that he has dragged them to this point. And now if they can keep the momentum going, they can get into that next tier because they are, let's see, they're 2.5 behind the Lakers, and it's tight in the top three. Clippers, Jazz, Lakers are all within a game of one another. So we'll see. But, we are very guilty nationally, at least, of not spending enough time putting that spotlight on Denver. So they're doing good things, and you got to be watching.
Let me ask you something, and it's probably going to sound ridiculous as a question. If you two were building a team that you wanted to win a championship and you got your choice of one superstar and you're thinking about winning in the playoffs as well, would you take Nikola Jokic or Giannis?
I would I mean, I'm top of mind and is Jokic.
You have to actually think about this, though, yeah. don't you? Imagine that. Yeah, I mean, imagine that question a few months ago, you know.
My hesitation was almost admittedly kind of, I mean, call it insecurity, like it's going to sound bad, but like I was in the bubble and I love Giannis's game, but it's yeah. it's puzzling to see.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know what's going on between you and Coach Budenholzer and the rest of this group, but I don't like it. I don't like how it looks when it's the playoffs. And all credit to the Heat for getting to the finals. That was not an all-time team. That was not an all-time defense. That was not, you know, those were not new tricks that Eric Spoelstra pulled out. To slow down what Giannis did, and he couldn't get around it, and not only that, but didn't
shoot. He just, I mean, that's just yeah. it comes down to it. Like at some point, his progress is gonna. It seems like he's built himself to this top level of what he can be because of what he's done, you know, physically and getting to the rim. But if he's not going to be able to hit mid range jumpers, which he can't, he's 30% or so. Can't hit threes, which he can't, you know, at a NBA good 3-point shooter level, and even free throws. He's defendable in the playoffs, and I didn't want to get on like a Giannis, you know, killing him rant. But my point, like, right. this is a Jokic conversation of like, you know, Giannis has been viewed as just like the next era of best player in the league. I mean, every single franchise should just be begging to somehow like get in a room with him. You could argue Jokic would make more sense for teams for, you know, not that Denver's going to give him up or that there's any, you know, sniff of that. But I'm just saying, like, it's crazy how that shifted over the last year. And a lot of it's because one performed really well in the playoffs and the other hasn't necessarily.
You think Jokic or Embiid is having the better year right now?
Because
those two guys are high on that MVP list.
Yeah. I trust Jokic long-term more, maybe because that's because I trust his health more. And the, you know,
yeah.
that's probably what I'd say. I, like Embiid.
Well, and he's trending.
Embiid has been spectacular defensively.
He has, yeah. Well, and I love, listen, Jokic's fitness is a major factor too. Credit to him for going in the right direction there, because that part was a problem previously. And I think that, you know, even the short offseason might have helped him because he was raring to go, you know, through the playoffs and was dominant and then didn't have that much downtime, you know, and he looks really good there. And so the health and the sustainability, I think, you know, is better for him now than it was before.
See, it's crazy to me, and this is just the way it's going to be. One of those guys is not going to be first team All-NBA, and they could keep playing like this. And one of those guys is going to feel unbelievably slighted at the end of the year by finishing top three or four in MVP and not making first team All-NBA because they got the right. one center spot. And it's going to be weird to see one of those guys after averaging basically similar numbers, and Embiid has been unbelievable defensively, and just seeing one of those guys second team All-NBA. It'll be like when we see Kawhi Leonard second team All-NBA or... Wait, because Giannis and LeBron end up getting there and forward, you know? It's just that's the one this year with the weird snub that's not a snub.
Isn't that funny, though? Because over the last couple of years, the thought has been like they need to get the center off as a requirement on these ballots, on the All-Star ballots, because the center is going the wayside. Now it's just front court players. It's mostly just forwards. Two of the best three players in 2021 right now this season have been centers.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
No question. Slater, you mentioned Giannis, so perfect segue there. I'm going to make an executive decision like I often do and kind of gloss over the Nets defense discussion that we're going to have. We have it to different degrees every single week. They're still not defending people. 25th in defensive rating, still 5 points away from the all-time worst mark in that department. But, you know, I'm intrigued by the Giannis thing you brought up, and I want to get to our last thing that we wanted to break down this week, which is what we are deeming and then credit to Andrew Schlecht, super producer, the net rating investigation, and the fact that if you look at net rating on NBA.com/stats, it is widely considered, you know, one of the more reliable metrics to just essentially find out, you know, who's for real and who's not. A lot of times, though, it doesn't reconcile very well with the overall record. And to that end, right now, let me give you the top four teams in net rating for this current season. And we're, you know, we're coming up on a 1/3 mark, so a pretty good sample size. The LA Clippers, with a league best net rating of plus 7.8, they have a record of 16-5 as of this recording. The Lakers, right there with the Clippers, tied 7.8, a 15-6 record. The Milwaukee Bucks, Giannis's Bucks, with the third best net rating in the league. Again, normally an indicator of you know, a team's legitimacy, if you will. But the Bucks are only 11-8. And then the Jazz coming in at 7.2 and a record of 15-5. But let's hone in on the Bucks. A lot of changes this offseason. All-time pace offensively right now. They are scoring the hell out of the ball. But the defense has taken a slide. They are currently... let's see how deep down they are. The Bucks are the 17th best defense in the NBA. This group has been one or two the last couple of years. How do you guys see their overall landscape?
So they've just been getting pounded on threes. They've always been a team that has given up a ton of three-pointers, and that's kind of been their strategy. They pack the paint. Nobody's getting to the rim. We're going to give up above the break threes. That's just kind of their defensive strategy. And you look at those last three games, and I think their opponents have hit 23s against them all three times. Charlotte hit 21 against them the other night. They're just getting killed on threes. And then you go and you check their shot profile, and it's still really good defensively. They're kind of giving up a lot of the similar shots that they were in years past. They're doing some different stuff schematically this year. I think they're switching a little bit more and they're sending their big guys a little farther from the rim progressively throughout games. But I feel like the defense is going to come back. I don't know if it's definitely not as elite as it was last year when they had the number one defense in the league. But I have a feeling them being at 17 right now that's not going to keep up. That's my take. I think they're going to climb into the top 10.
Here's my net rating investigation. They beat the Warriors on Christmas Day by 39, and then I believe they beat the Heat by like 47 a couple days later. And in a 20-game sample or whatever it is now, 21, 22, that is just going to spike your net rating when you have basically nearly a plus 100 on two games. And if I just filtered it to just look at their last 15, because they played 19, I just looked. It's a plus 5.2 net rating, which is probably more, you know, representative of what they've been. They lost to the Hornets this week. They lost to the Pelicans, who've been terrible this week. And then I watched that Lakers-Bucks game. What was that, about 10 days ago or so on TNT? Lakers look like they cruised to a win over them. You know, Lakers didn't even play that well, and they just I've kind of been a Nets or a Bucks hater on this podcast through however many episodes we've done, so I guess I'm kind of like leaning into it. I don't believe in them in the playoffs. I don't.
I like how you and I have just completely balanced each other out on the Bucks. Nets, we've been the great Bucks equalizers on this podcast.
And I'll come in and be the gray area guy. To Fred's point on the three-pointer front, I was just looking at it. So they're third worst in the league, opponent three-pointers per game, 15.2. Comparing that to last year, and I never seem to have the perfect timing as I search for stats. Where the hell is Milwaukee? Last year, 14. So, you know, about 1.2 more this season. And that's the kind of stuff that decides games. So, tweaks and changes and Drew Holiday coming to town, you know, again, been really good offensively, not so great across the board defensively. We'll see where they go. To Slater's general point, though, independent of the stats, I think I'm on Team Slater at the moment in regards to trust. I just don't feel like I like what they have happening out there. Now, I do love their culture. I've said that for a long time. I think that goes a very long way. And you know, it's going to have to grow. And even to, all, you know, to be honest, take it back to the Rudy Gobert conversation I had a little bit, you know, a team like Utah with that continuity and those hardships and those growing pains, if you will, that's real stuff. And so it's hard to handicap right now where the Bucks are going to be at in terms of, call it their ethos or their psyche or kind of who they are as a group a few months down the road, given the fact that most of their core has kind of, you know, had some scabs together and had to get through some tough times.
Yeah, Sam, just getting back to the three-point thing to add on to it. So opponents are shooting over 40% on threes against them. That is the worst percentage in the league for any defense.
Right.
Now, for the most part, that sort of stat tends to even out over the course of the year when you play other teams. Like, they're giving up a high percentage on open shots, which is something that's just kind of out of their hands. And they're giving up the right kinds of shots. Like, they give up very few corner threes. And you don't give up shots at the rim. They got to come somewhere else. I don't know. I'm a believer. They're not what they were last year defensively, but I think they're good.
They're stubborn in their style, though. And
yes,
they
had, for
and,
sure.
And their weaknesses can... at the wrong matchup. I mean, that's what we saw with Miami, right? Oh, they love to give up, you know, top of the break threes. Well, Duncan Robinson, Tyler, all those guys just were just raining in threes. And then if you pack the paint on Giannis in a playoff situation, as Miami did, and play physical with a bunch of guys who can theoretically guard him physically, he's not efficient enough to you know, make up for the fact that Duncan Robinson and whoever's hitting enough threes to... They handled, you know, Sam mentioned them losing to not that great of a Heat team. They got easily beat in that series, right? I mean, that was the other thing.
And you could see it coming early in the series, and you kept assuming that they would, you know, make the adjustments, and they didn't come. And then I know we might in the media make too much of this, but I was never a big fan of the way they handled the reaction post loss media wise. It just didn't, the fire wasn't there. There was a lot of, you know, some shoulders, not shoulder shrugging, but it just didn't seem like a group that was, you know, going to lose sleep that night. And I'm sure they did. I'm not trying to downplay the way it hurt them. But I just still am trying to watch them and see who they are as a group. And because that's, you know, you gotta care to an incredible degree. Good stuff as always, guys. Admittedly, I was trying to segue here. There's not an easy way to segue to this. And my mind already started going to a different place emotionally as we kind of wrap up here. About a week ago, excuse me, by the time the pod comes out, it will have been a week since we lost a very, very good friend, Sekou Smith, at the age of 48. Longtime friend of mine, going back to his Atlanta Hawks beat writing days for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I'm sure the listeners, you know, because you're big basketball fans, you've seen all the tributes, you've heard stories, and, you know, it speaks volumes of the decibel level, if you will, of the reaction in our community. And it's not just the media, it's coaches, it's players, it's across the board. We should all aspire, whenever our time comes, to elicit this kind of reaction, because it was well earned from a man who was incredibly kind, incredibly talented. And the part that does hit me the hardest is that I never met Sekou's family, his wife Heather and his three kids, but anybody who was around him at all knew what he meant to them, what, you know, what they meant to him. And is that's for me the toughest part, is him as a leader of his family, and the fact that they're not going to get him in his older years like they should have is really tough. Obviously, COVID-19 is just incredibly serious, and it took him very quickly. And I can't believe he's gone. Last week, guys, I had done a Charles Barkley interview, had a great time talking to Chuck, got off the phone like an hour later. Got a phone call from John Schumann, buddy from NBA.com, and just want to make sure we give him a space on the pod this week to make sure. I mean, I'm never going to forget this man. He helped me when I was coming up as a beat writer on the Sacramento Kings for the Sacramento Bee, and I'll be honest, you know, all the way through was one of those guys that if I was ever down for confidence, if I was ever down for belief, was almost like a coach, where he'd be in my backside saying, man, you can, you know, go break this, go look into this story. And I never even worked with this guy in terms of the same company. you know, I don't, we've said a lot, but he's going to be sorely, sorely missed. I want to give you guys a chance. I don't know if you knew him, in your journeys, but, how do you feel here?
I probably had, I don't know, the 112th closest relationship of anybody in NBA media to him. You know, I don't have detailed stories. You know, you mentioned Marcus Thompson wrote something up there. There's journalists all over who've had much closer relationship with him, but it shows the type of person he is where it hit me hard. And I only saw him once a year, twice a year, maybe. Hey, I'm in Atlanta. I'm going to shoot around. And then he comes in the building and it's immediately, you know, he comes right up to you and he wants to have a conversation and, you know, he wants to go to lunch. He was very outgoing in that sense. And particularly with younger writers, you know, when I was covering the Thunder, he would do that. And yeah, I mean, like I said, the fact that it hit me hard and considering where I am in the pecking order of relationships with him, I can't imagine the people closest to him.
Yeah, you know, I never really got to know him, to be honest. I'd met him, but I just always loved his work. That was kind of my experience with Seiko. I just always admired how much enthusiasm he put into his job. I really like, especially in a media landscape where there's so much, I don't know if contentiousness is the right word in media, but there's so much, it's so much debate and you can get negative energy in so many different places. And I just always found his work.
It's competitive and it's, you know, yeah, different personalities all in the same space.
Definitely. And my favorite writers and my favorite media personalities are the ones who you can just tell exude positive energy. You can read what they write. And you can feel coming through the screen or through the page how enthusiastic they are about whatever subject they're writing about. And I think he very, very firmly always fit into that category. You know, when you'd see him on TV or see him in a video thing, he was just so enthusiastic always. And that's contagious. And honestly, it's inspiring to somebody who is trying to get to the level that he was at, you know? So I always admired that. And I always just thought he was fantastic and really admired him from afar.
Two quick things about him before we go, in terms of like last memories, I know we always end up, you know, being tough on ourselves when people are gone, but I wish I had known somehow we knew that this was coming. 'Cause I spent 2 months with him inside the bubble and during the playoffs. And now you kind of find yourself going, you know, this one night I hung out with this person and I love them, but they're still around. If I knew that was going to be it with Sekou, I would have been having dinner with him every single night and pushing my way on to he had these hilarious bike rides that he would go on with Mark Spears and Chris Haynes and Morgan Mitchell was their main group. I think Steve Smith joined at one point where they would take these bicycles that were in short supply in the bubble and make a habit out of riding around the perimeter, which was a stress relief thing where they would talk, they would, you know, Sekou even bit the dust one time, which we heard about. He had a little crash that they were all giving him a hard time about. But he was jovial, spirit-wise in the bubble. I remember walking into the media room in the bubble one day and seeing this big stack of books. And I mean, I should have been prepared here to drop a plug for the book, but it was a book about kind of controlling your mind and being the most effective person you can be. And I saw this big old stack of books and Sekou was in the room and I was like, you have any idea like why these books are here? Like what this is all about? And he's like, oh, it's actually a buddy of mine who wrote it and he was trying to help his friend out. So he had gotten a bunch of these books and was trying to disperse them out to media with the hopes of getting a promotion, which maybe I'll plug in next week to make sure I follow through. But like that tells you the kind of guy he was. He was always trying to help people. And again, he'll be very sorely missed. I think on the media side, one thing that, you know, hasn't been talked about a lot, it's not necessarily a tribute as much as it is just industry talk, is to go from being a very good beat writer to then getting a job, I think around 2009, where on TV anyways, his main role was, if you guys remember with that old jump show with Dennis Scott, they would have Sekou sitting in front of a laptop, sometimes standing, and monitoring social media. And it was hilarious to look back on because they almost talked about social media like it was this fly-by-night little gimmicky thing that they were going to let Sekou handle over in the corner. You know what I mean? Like, hey, Sekou, what's happening on the Twitter or whatever it might be? And he would read a few tweets and you kind of wondered watching it like, all right, like interesting role. You know, I wonder, you know, if he's going to fill that lane for a while, does he like that lane? And I'll be honest, I remember thinking like, man, my guy like knows what's happening in the league. Put him on the damn set and let him talk about the league. And then over time, that's exactly what happened. His voice grew, his role grew. In terms of like industry or career arcs, I can't think of anybody else who made that kind of a pivot. And he was still writing, but by the end, you know, he had found a way to have the kind of role that honestly is pretty tough to carve out.
Yeah, and he was great on the pods too. Like Hang Time Pod was
No question.
Great podcast. Must listen podcast. He was so good on those.
It was indeed. All right, guys, tough stuff. But thank you as always. We will be back next week to break things down. Have a good week, gentlemen. Appreciate you.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.